Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. Joined in the studio here today as our special guest, we have Nicole Holtzmark, who's head of commercial platforms and data products with Condé Nast International, or CNI. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're very delighted to have you. And I have to say, my guests keep getting more and more complicated job titles, and that becomes the biggest hurdle of the day. Get the job title right.
Nailed it. You're fine.
Thank you. And ExchangeWise Head of Content, Lindsay Rowntree, back in the hot seat. Hi.
Hiya.
How are you doing there, Lindsay?
Really well,
chirpy,
thank you.
Chirpy, I love it.
Absolutely.
Just delighted to not be sound guy again, I think, aren't you?
Definitely.
Okay, so let's get started with our first news story for the week that I wanted to chat with the two of you about. News came out, I think, yesterday or the day before that private equity firm Blackstone is set to acquire mobile in-app ad network Vungle for an undisclosed sum that is hotly rumoured to be $750 million. I love those sorts of reports. Undisclosed, but somebody who is very familiar with the matter is right. Able to state it's $750 million.
Multiple sources tell us this is it.
$750 million in cash. So I wanted to hear your perspectives on this. The reason that we thought it's, we always find it interesting when obviously an ad tech platform is purchased and, or acquired. It's quite interesting that this is another private equity deal. Mm-hmm. So it's showing that there's still interest from private equity in ad tech. And it also says something, in my opinion, about the confidence of investors in mobile advertising and mobile advertising platforms. Now, at ExchangeWire, over the last sort of 6 to 12 months, we've been talking a lot about the value of in-app advertising from a brand advertiser's perspective, and that that still is very much a channel for opportunity that perhaps hasn't necessarily been harnessed to date. And I think that $750 million, rumoured figure in cash suggests that Vungle are probably doing very well. Otherwise, I can't see private equity firms dumping up that much in that deal arrangement.
Well, no, it's their job to make more money out of that.
Exactly.
Than what they put in. So
they must see the something. Potential that they see. Yeah. So, yes, I just wanted your opinions on this. Nicole, let's get started with you.
Sure. So I actually wasn't familiar with Vungle, but I spent a little bit of time looking into it. And I think the thing that stands out to me is that it's not an obvious ad format. It's not sort of a standard. Their USP seems to be that the ads they run are customized, interactive, and fold into the user experience, which is why they're running very successfully on gaming apps primarily. Yeah. All of their success, most of their success stories were from gaming apps that were on the producer side, or the publisher, equivalent publisher side, very pleased with the yields they were generating, which they should for completely customized, beautiful advertising, but also with how seamlessly it integrated with their existing user experience.
Yeah.
And then all of the quotes from the buy side were very pleased with the results and the engagement and the effectiveness of these ads, which of course, if you're building something that completely stitches into the experience, but is still very clearly an advertisement, you should get strong results on both sides. It should win for everybody. And I think I was pleased to see that that seems to be the thing they're trading on, because it's signaling that you can focus on quality and user experience and how your brand will be perceived when associated with the existing environment. And that can pay off, you can make a business out of that. That's not just your, not a honey trap, but like the thing that you put out there to show everybody, but actually behind the scenes, you're flogging banners.
Yeah. The classic and smoke and mirrors that we also talk about.
We do talk about that a lot. Yes. Yeah.
So it does not, it appears anyway, that the whole foundation is these strong creative executions, but also clearly coupled with good advice, good due diligence, good strategic guidance for their clients of how best to build these ads and where to place them. A lot of the success stories were founded around, like, we spent time really planning what metrics we're going to measure here and what we're going to aim for and what's the purpose of this campaign, which is a very consultative selling approach that, again, isn't massively scalable. It's very difficult to train salespeople to do that well. There's a lot of competing factors that salespeople need to remember all the time, which is why, the big companies end up having 7 supporting teams just for the salesperson to function in digital, because otherwise they would constantly be promising things that can't be done. So having that element successfully running in conjunction with these strong creatives, I think that that might be a big part of what this company sees, that this is something that this model, if it's done well, and if it can be, if the money can be spent on infrastructure to scale that up or make it wider or take it to new markets, then that, that does make sense. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
A lot more sense.
That's really interesting, actually, because you've just touched on the things that I feel like we've talked about quite a lot in the context of mobile, the opportunity in mobile in-app advertising, that if you get the format right, you can create this experience that's not intrusive to the user. We talk a lot about how important that is in a mobile context and mobile environment, because there are whole markets out there, I'm thinking APAC here, where there are mobile-first consumers that are just doing absolutely everything on their mobile phone. So any kind of format that doesn't interrupt their experience is going to be really well received there. So, you know, when I was reading this, I was thinking, well, is this in terms of sort of growth and future prospects for Vungle beyond this acquisition, are they looking to new markets where perhaps they do have a presence but they want to expand their presence? Are they looking at ways to scale the technology to make that sort of seamless and creative experience a little more accessible or able to roll that out at a higher volume? Lindsay, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, actually, to continue with the point of sort of the creative side of things, I think, so Vungle are very, very big in the gaming space. They have a lot of gaming companies as clients. And there are many other competitors in that space that operate in a similar way to Vungle. And where they win in the gaming space is the creative. And as well as being the kind of the demand partner for these big gaming companies, they also work very, very closely with them on creative execution. And because most gaming companies don't engage with agencies, they tend to have everything running in-house, these companies like Vungle will actually create everything for them and do all the creative execution for them. And it's a really smart way for gaming companies to be able to keep iterating their creatives and keep engaging their kind of highly like high sensitive users that want to be able to understand, want to be able to be attracted by kind of bright colours and everything else. So Vungle have done always done very, very, very well at that. And actually, it's interesting to note that Vungle have clients like P&G, Warner Brothers, Pandora and NFL, like you wrote in the notes, Rachel, because it means that this gamification is that we talk about a lot is actually working and people are understanding that actually if I want to get in front of clients that are using in-app that are engaging with apps all the time, companies like Vungle are the way to go. And actually gamification is how I can continue to engage these customers that aren't responding the same way to a classic banner ad. And there are many competitors to Vungle that are trying to get clients outside of gaming. They've mastered the gaming industry now and they want to be talking to the FMCGs to help them understand how they can win in the in-app world as well. So I think Vungle are in a really strong position. And there's a lot of PE money floating around at the moment. And I think Vungle have done very well to kind of get, if it's true, get that kind of potential valuation.
Yeah, and deal.
Yeah.
What does it also say about the value of gaming audiences as well, I wonder? Because like you say, Vungle have had a lot of success in the gaming environment. I wonder if it's also there, you know, there's probably just loads more potential actually in that field. I'm sure they're wanting to expand beyond gaming, but we were talking quite a lot when we were at ATS in Singapore a couple of weeks ago that the gaming audience just doesn't look like the stereotype of gaming audiences 4 and 5 years ago. It's so much more mainstream, particularly in those sorts of regions where, you know, where people are sort of buried in mobile phone transactions all the time. But I wonder if this says something about the potential of gaming audiences when it comes to, you know, building brand, to getting, you know, advertising messages out there. What are your thoughts?
Presumably
on that
it can only be growing because everybody's getting older. They're just playing different games, right?
Yeah.
So I can only assume that there will be continued growth as the population ages and the younger generation joins in. They'll just pick different games, new games, wider variety of games. There'll be more of them.
Yep.
I don't think you grow out of them the same way that you would grow out of, like, you know, Sega Genesis back in the 90s or whatever, because it's with you all the time. And you see 50-year-old men still stuck on Candy Crush on the tube, just staring at it, absorbed massively.
Yeah.
And the fact that they don't age out, but the fresh ones still come in, means it must be growing. It must continue to grow. So that whole captivated audience is, they want to be entertained and they want to be, they're killing time. They want to get to the next level. They want to interact with things. And if it's a brand coming in and interrupting the experience, they probably don't care as long as it's still a game, as long as it's still the experience. So I guess it's about identifying the brand, the non-gaming advertisers that have a suitable relevant call to action for the user to do. Like, yeah. Some brands just aren't going to be able to translate for that environment in the same way, because what are you going to ask them to do at that point to make it a game? Like, it might not actually suit your own brand to be there making a game out of your own brand.
Yeah,
that makes
totally.
Sense.
And that, I guess that's where the kind of the whole reward of video and the whole ad format thing within app comes into question. And a lot of companies, let's use P&G's example, we just talked about it, they would look at a rewarded video and go, well, that's not for me, that's a game would use rewarded video to promote another game because they can win coins right. or whatever else. And it's like, no, you have to kind of think differently. And that's where companies like Vungle can help them think differently and say, no, you can gamify an ad about something like generic, like toothpaste. Yeah. You absolutely can. You can use it for coupons, you can use it for something else, but there are ways of doing this, engaging your audience, because this is a way that they will actually interact with your ad, and there'll probably be a much higher brand recall with that kind of advertising than there would be a simple banner ad or some other kind of online format. So there's a lot for kind of companies like Vungle to do. There's a massive opportunity for them to expand outside of the gaming world to kind of help understand how, because gaming really gets it. They have so much first party data. They understand their audiences so well. They really nailed like lifetime values. So they know how to attain their audiences. And how to target them in the right way and how to show them the right ads. And rewarded video has been a massive, massive win for a lot of these gaming companies. And there's so much more that that brands, non-gaming brands can do in the rewarded video space that I think companies like Vungle will help them kind of tap into.
Mm-hmm. It's just really interesting, isn't it, to watch that trajectory towards sophistication. You know, it wasn't that long ago that gaming audiences were considered sort of low value because there was a presumption that they were young and not spending and so forth.
And clicking by mistake.
And gaming, particularly on mobile, gaming meant casino or it meant bingo.
Right. That's right.
It doesn't mean that anymore.
No, it's a whole other...
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of the gambling... My brain immediately went to fun games.
Crush. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Not gambling games, but you're absolutely right. Of course, there's a whole parallel universe over there, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this is obviously sort of a good story for the growth in mobile and in-app advertising and the sort of possibilities there. What about it being a sort of a good news story for ad tech? Does it say anything about, I mean, I know that in the past we've talked about, we talk about a lot of things with regards to acquisitions in ad tech. We talk about consolidation and consolidation of that sort of middle layer within the technology spectrum. But we also talk about how differentiated ad tech solutions are the ones that are really going to sort of win out at the end of the day. What do you think about this as a general story for ad tech acquisitions, Nicole?
Well, I think it's generally very positive because it's not a mainstream. It's not a division of Google that's developed a creative services arm.
Absolutely.
Or a division of any company that's decided to siphon off and make a branded content studio or something like that. So I think it's a very positive story. And I think, again, it sort of is demonstrating that there's an appetite still to put money towards good products and high quality services. I think that part probably stands out to me, that there's quite a lot of human effort and expertise going along with the actual technology and the creative services, which I'm sure there's lots of companies doing it, but it's a good sign that is generating enough interest to attract price tags like that, if it's true.
And it's valuable. Yeah.
And also, Vungle have had legal challenges with their leadership over the few years ago.
Have.
I mean, that's with their former CEO, Zane Jaffa. So, I mean, the fact that everything was all the charges were dropped, everything was thrown out of court. And I think this PE investment will actually mean that they can settle with Zane as well. But
yeah, I think they did.
Yeah, they have done.
It was
one
of the sort of onward journeys I clicked on.
Yeah. Yes.
I clicked on the clickbait, and they did settle. And he put out a statement that just said he was really proud that all the hard work they'd put in has
been
resulted.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was very scandalous at the time. And it was only a couple of years ago. And actually, you know, don't underestimate how much a scandal can affect a company, even if that scandal turns out to be kind of unfounded and untrue. But that could have caused Vungle a lot of problems. They could have lost clients off the back of it because it was quite severe charges being made. Mm. So it's good to see that actually that's kind of been put to the wayside and Vungle were able to continue to do what they do best and not let those kinds of things affect them, because many companies have gone under for similar things.
Indeed, similar scandals.
And the statement that went along with the announcement from their CEO now, I guess, was I found a little bit confusing, though, because he said that they were looking forward, you know, to partnering to sort of continue on their mission to be the trusted guide for growth and engagement. Like, basically, it sounded like their mission was for their creative to be a way for people to discover other apps and other services, which is good. But like you said, that's more about people downloading other games.
Yeah.
So that seemed different from the diversification of non-gaming advertiser mission. So yeah, I wonder how they're going to choose to balance those priorities.
Well, that's the thing. It's perhaps a nod to where at the moment they're seeing a trajectory or growth, but I wonder how that will actually play out because it entirely depends on what markets they're going for as well.
Yeah.
I'd have thought, I know that they've got presence already in APAC, but I don't know how strong they are in comparison to some of their competitors out there. I don't know. I mean, you know, there's still parts of that market that are completely untapped in terms of volume. So perhaps this is a nod to where their intentions are now.
Yeah.
And maybe that's going to change.
Well, like with change of leadership and change of, you know, new money coming in and
that's
everything,
right.
I imagine everything's kind of up. Not everything's not up for debate, but like there, you should look out for more changes of direction, right?
Because I guess so.
They'll be maybe having all those conversations
to announcing something further down the line that's
right.
Kind of a change of direction in some way or another.
Exactly.
Right, or maybe they'll spin off a new division.
Yeah.
They're big enough now.
In collaboration with Google.
Right. Getting some of that investment money.
But also, just quickly, the PE talk side yes. of things, which you talked about, was obviously Nia, a company that, you know, we've known very well
yes.
over the years, based in Singapore.
Originally, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. They've just got $100 million in PE funding as well. So there's clearly a lot of PE money sloshing around.
Yeah.
I used to think of them as a location company. They're trying to branch away from being known as a location company, but it's definitely kind of a mobility company, looking at data from people and motion and everything else. So the fact that, given the uncertainty with location data, not just in Europe, but actually globally, I mean, they are an APAC firm, but they do have presence
global
in
presence,
Europe,
yeah.
shows that there's still money around for people that are trying to navigate that and, yeah, differentiate. Exactly.
Differentiated propositions or differentiated ideas, or at least have the head start on bits and pieces of technology that are really taking the industry or taking potential customers to where they need to go. So anything around data, anything around growth areas or still yet to grow and mature channels like mobile seems to be the area that investors are most interested in, right? Yeah, interesting times. Okay, moving on to the second story, I wanted to talk through just a couple of stories relating to Facebook that have come out in the news this week, late last week and then early this week. The first is obviously Facebook appearing in front of the US Senate Banking Committee, providing testimony on how their cryptocurrency Libra should be regulated. And the second is that the FTC announced their intention to fine Facebook $5 million US, 5 million or
it's
5 billion.
I think,
yes,
yeah.
I was thinking that looked a little low.
Well,
what kind
even
of a world do we live
is...
in? Yeah, $5 billion US dollars for their part in the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And so there was a couple of things around both of these stories that I wanted to talk about with the two of you. Regarding the cryptocurrency, I find it really interesting that there's a debate raging about how whether Facebook are best placed to be sort of running and operating this cryptocurrency. I mean, they have talked about the management arrangements that they want to set up, and that it will be, you know, guided by an independent sort of Swiss banking facility.
The Libra Association.
Yes.
Which has no banks in it.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So a Swiss Libra Association facility owned by Facebook. I don't know.
Some sort of like governing body. There are 28 people, 28 companies in it now, including like MasterCard, Visa and PayPal, but also
Spotify
and Farfetch and
like Lyft and
Lyft.
Yeah,
and some other
interesting variety.
And then some not-for-profit companies as well.
Yeah. And then they want to expand that group up to 100.
Yes.
And that's
going to
be the governing body of this highly complex
part of the governing body as well.
Well, yeah, right. They're the major, they form the major sort of, no doubt, voting power, probably
stakeholder. If you
stakeholder,
like.
Yes. Thank you. Major stakeholder in the governing in the governing body. I mean, a governing body of up to 100 participants. Well, you've got to have structures to make that work, right? And so that's what's interesting about what's going on in the Banking Senate Committee this week. Is a lot of questions being put to Facebook, not just about how they handle data privacy and how they respond to regulation and control, but also a discussion discussion about whether, you know, what that management and infrastructure would look like. Mm. And of course, you know, President Trump's come out very proactively saying if Facebook wants to behave like a bank, then they're going to have to be subject to banking regulations. So that's probably one of the reasons why they're carefully avoiding the term bank in any of the regulatory controls that they're proposing. But it is fascinating to watch this play out, right? It feels like there's a few things going on at the same time that sort of understandable concern around how Facebook manages privacy and data, but also how it responds to regulation and control. And that's then linked to the Cambridge Analytica, you know, scenario and incident. And then there's also a big question about whether morally Facebook's the right company to be forging ahead with something like a universal cryptocurrency, which they have stated was to be put, you know, was the idea behind it, the ethos behind it is to make a form of payment available in countries where currencies are unstable, where people don't have access to the same infrastructure. You can completely understand why some of the private companies that are interested in being part of the sort of you know, management structure or the governing structure, like Lyft, like Farfetch, those sort of DTC platforms, businesses and brands could be interested in this because it could be a way for people to pay for their services in other countries mm-hmm. where currencies are unstable or where infrastructure doesn't exist. So I can sort of see where this is going, but there's a whole bunch of things that are playing out in front of our eyes at the same time, I think. What are your thoughts on this, Nicole?
This one's tough because, like, as a consumer, like as an individual myself, there's the Cambridge Analytica thing, and then there's a whole gulf of difference between the data that was being used or the application of that data, and we're talking about your money, like your personal funds and how they're being managed and held. And that to me, like, I guess sitting where I sit, living in the UK, I probably just wouldn't put my money there.
Yeah.
But that brings us back to, it's not really meant for me. It's meant for
other potential customers
who don't have bank accounts, but do have phones.
Yeah.
And in those cases, I can absolutely see why that's a valuable service and a valuable way to get people on the grid and trading and paying for things in a stable way. But it's not a bank, but it is a bank. And it's not a currency, but it is a currency. And it all just feels like if it's not going to be governed, like if in a scenario where it's not governed like a bank, well, then who's governing it? And how is anybody going to be following, able or equipped or capable of following up on the promises that they won't share data between the wallet, the Calibra thing that Facebook's building, and Facebook's advertising network.
Yeah.
Like, they say that they won't, or that they won't without the user's explicit permission.
But they haven't got a great track record in that department.
Well, it's just very... Not yet, not so far.
Yeah. I mean, you know, watch and no doubt, you know, they'll be coming forward with all sorts of assurances that it will be handled differently. You would absolutely expect them to be doing that. But I can also, on the other hand, understand how governments are trying to get, you know, and the US government in particular is trying to get in the way of this to say, you know, actually anything to do with banking and funds, you know, has to be really tightly controlled. Yeah. And so if you're willing to adhere to some of these controls, then maybe that's a different story. But if what you want to do is propose something completely separate and new and different and international and collaborative and all of those things, well, how is that actually going to be governed? And what happens, which is the key question, when something goes wrong? That's what everybody will be really concerned about, because that's the thing that will prevent you from getting involved in the first instance. What do you reckon, Lindsay?
But I mean, I guess when something goes wrong, it's the idea of it isn't that it won't lie on Facebook's shoulders. It will lie on the collective shoulders of everybody, because it's built on blockchain, right? So it's designed to be a ledger of record that every single person on that record has access to and can stop or start something. So Facebook, the idea of it is that Facebook would never have overall control over any one part of it, and that's why kind of Libra exists. And Facebook have not said that, you know, well, Facebook isn't launching Libra. Libra is being launched by all these collective companies of which Facebook is a part of. And at the same time, because there's no real understanding yet as to how you would govern anything built on blockchain internationally, you can't really call what they're doing a bank, because it's not a bank. So actually, should it be held up to the same sort of banking regulations in one particular market. Because I don't even think that Facebook care about going after the US really for Libra, because there are, you know, in the opening line of their white paper, they point out the astounding fact that 1.7 billion people in the world are unbanked. Mm. They have no bank at all, largely due to what you mentioned earlier, Rachel, like kind of infrastructure problems or being nowhere near a bank or not trusting banks or whatever, or being in unstable markets. And two-thirds of those people have access to a smartphone. Mm. So they should be able to have access to some kind of finance should they require it. And that's not necessarily going to be in the US as such. It's going to be more in the emerging markets. That's where Facebook's trying to get into. And we talked, you know, a few weeks ago with Chris Stevenson about the fact that actually there's markets like Brazil where WhatsApp is the kind of the main communication tool of record, and everyone uses WhatsApp in Brazil. So that's going to be a market that will be huge for them, where they can kind of share transactions over WhatsApp. Like, that's what Facebook are going after. That's what Libra is going after. So I just find, I don't know, I think that it's right to be investigated. But I think that no one's really investigated this kind of thing yet. So I think no one knows where to start. And I don't think you can come at it with banking regulations, because actually banking regulations and trying to apply them over the top of it might not work. So what is the alternative? How do you come at it from a different approach, using different expertise from the blockchain community, not the banking community, because they can't necessarily have the same understanding?
That's what I think is really tricky, right? Is that so it's slightly uncharted territory. I would argue that, you know, in a marketplace or in an environment where they're trying to provide a service or a facility for people that don't have bank accounts, then maybe they're not providing a traditional banking function, but they are providing a function that banks hitherto provide in other markets. So they're providing some kind of merchant or payment facility, which mostly has been traditionally in the hands of banks. Of course, there's loads of challenges to that these days, which has been great and a welcome introduction, because it meant that banks no longer have the monopoly on providing those merchant facilities, and it means that new solutions can, you know, mix up the fee structure and provide services to people in different and slightly more convenient ways. But I would argue in that instance, Libra is providing some kinds of payment or merchant facility, which is sort of along the lines of the kind of thing. It's in banking territory. Might not be classic banking, but it's where banks have provided that service before in the past. Now, so what's actually going on here? Is it the banks are getting annoyed about that because they're thinking, well, not banks themselves, but, you know, on behalf of, if governments are stepping forward saying you've got to adhere to banking regulations if you're going to run it like this, can you imagine the banking sector in the background going, yeah, absolutely, because you're kind of cutting our grass here? Because I bet there are a lot of global banks that are trying hard to set up payment and merchant facilities in emerging countries and not finding it so easy for many reasons. So are they concerned about competition from something like cryptocurrency, or is it really that actually governments are just concerned about control and safety and protection? It's a bit difficult to know exactly what's going on here.
Black cab drivers in London, being with Uber.
Mm. But you raise a good point that there are, you're right, there's probably mainstream banks trying to do this in emerging markets, and there must be a good reason why it's not happening. Well, probably mixed in with some bad ones, but there's probably some fundamental barriers to entry that, you know, maybe Libra just won't get there. Like, maybe this is just a very ambitious project that sounds great, and there's going to be a million things that get in the way, and we just have to keep watching it. But one of the main differences I understood here is from normal cryptocurrencies is that this one will be underpinned by reserves held by someone to be confirmed. Mm. And the interest generated on those reserves, which in a normal banking model, I guess, go to subsidize things like points programs or whatever, would be paid back to the investors in the Libra Association. I think that's what I understood from what they've set out, how they said they're going to organize themselves. Mm. So in that case,
well, that's
it's
a fund.
Definitely that's like a fund, right? Mm. It's not quite a credit card function, because if they're not holding reserves, you could maybe align it to credit cards instead, which are all, there's also regulation there about, you know, if something doesn't work out or you don't get the thing that you paid for, you can complain to your credit card company and they might help you refund. Like, there's rules about what they have to provide too, but in those cases you pay for it first and then you pay them back, or they pay for it for you and you pay them back with interest. But if they're holding funds, then it is much more like a debit card, where you put your money up front, get your currency out, and then you spend it on things. So the user behavior, the service that they're expecting and the protections that they're expecting would much more closely aligned to banking regulation. I think more than anything, they probably just want to avoid the mistake of not regulating it at all, and then it's too late.
Yeah,
like
for sure.
With data and digital advertising, where it was so new and moved so fast that the laws and the rules that were set out at the beginning were very quickly
superseded,
not relevant anymore, or completely insufficient, or not applicable. And like everybody making fun of the way the governing bodies were talking about data when they were interviewing Mark Zuckerberg, and sort of being like, "Oh, it's like my grandpa's, trying to ask me how to turn on the VCR or something."
Totally, and that was the other thing that struck me, which is unfair, but I mean, I know there needs to be some kind of conversation about this right now, but do we run the risk of trying to establish some rules in an environment where, firstly, we're not quite sure of the parameters, right, and secondly, we've got rulemakers who really don't understand what this is intended to do, what this is intended to provide. So I think it's going to be really interesting watching how that pans out. But Facebook, certainly having an interesting week on their hands.
Yeah, but them getting fined will do nothing.
I know.
And yeah,
that was anticipated anyway.
Yeah.
So that they have had that set aside.
Their stocks dropped slightly, but they've risen starkly ever since then. Mm. So they've got a Teflon.
Teflon. I think you're right, Lindsay. Okay, so from Teflon onto the third news story of the week. Market research company in the US, Advertiser Perceptions, they've released their annual report focusing on SSP use and adoption, with some good coverage by Ad Exchanger on this earlier on in the week. And they're noting that Amazon has shot up 8 places in the overall ranking to number two, which is a ranking of 18 of the most used SSPs. Number one position being consumed by Google's Ad Manager. So I'm really interested in your views on this, especially, Nicole, what with working for a publisher. They talked about some results across a number of indicators, such as buying intention, net promoter score, and brand familiarity. And they noted that Amazon was doing pretty well in almost all of those categories and was ranking number two to Google's services there. But they also noted that the Xandr platform, operated by AppNexus, comes in a close third, and sort of is vying for that second place position. And they really make the point that Google's still in a very strong position here with their SSP technology, but that Amazon's really breathing down their neck. And then there's a whole host of other SSP providers, OpenX, PubMatic, AppNexus, as I mentioned, and a few other household names that sort of are tussling about for other spots within that ranking. So what's your perception on this?
Yeah, I had a look through, and I think it's very clearly US-based research.
It is, yeah.
For example, I think they were saying that the publishers that were included in the research have an average of 8 SSPs, which is not a trend that you observe outside the US.
Moment. Yeah, 6 at the moment, and we'll use 8 or more next year, which I read that and I was like, are you joking?
Right, yeah.
That's low or that's high?
That seems high to me.
High.
That seems like the kind of thing you can do when you have a very large market with single language, single, national brands that are large, booking sizes that are very large, and teams that are very large to run 14 reports a day and manually check what's working, let alone make decisions about how to optimize or change it. One of the things I think that stood out on the feedback about Amazon was about the usability of their user interface and the quality of the reporting back. Mm. I left Telegraph just before we started experimenting with header bidding. And in my role at Condé Nast International, we don't do much of it, pockets of it, but that's because we're working outside the US primarily.
Yep.
I think in the US, publishers have been much more like, throw everything at it. We have all this unsold. We have to put it in 7 marketplaces, not specifically Condé Nast US, but just US publishers. And it's not clear, it's not immediately obvious to me how that works outside the US because of this scale that even small publishers have there.
Yep.
If you're going to make like 5% more on your eCPM, that's cool if at the bottom line that adds up to enough money to pay for all the people who are implementing and running and managing this and just having conversations with 8 vendors on a regular basis and troubleshooting things.
Because 5% on a lot is a lot in a market scales of the US.
But 5%
on a much more modest,
on a normal size publisher in any European country or pretty much any European country, it's just not necessarily going to pay for itself right away.
Right.
it's going to take more effort and more energy. So in order to make the business case profitable, you'd have to scale back on how much effort it is to run. So then you might gear yourselves more towards established tools that are easier to use. So the usability feedback, I think, is prominent here.
And the usability feedback was saying that the Amazon platform
that it's easier to use. I think the reporting is strong.
Yeah.
I've heard through the grapevine that the reporting is strong, because one of the biggest challenges with other providers, including Google, is generating a simple report that is accurate and provides like-for-like comparisons of net versus gross and eCPMs and broken down by size or by device or by whatever, in order to compare side by side what's actually working. Like, inventory management in itself is a challenge before adding 8 flavors of data that have labeled everything differently. Mm. And you have to configure them up front manually as well. So if you forgot to label that size separately or something, well, tough. You got to start over. You lost that data. So really just monitoring if it's working before you can even start deciding how many vendors to have to add more or to take them down. You're going to rely heavily on some sort of dashboarding function. Most publishers don't have robust data visualization teams that understand this well enough to pull it together into a way that you could actually run a business off of it. Mm. But if you are a publisher with a large enough pool of unsold inventory that you need to maximize, you would have the resources there, because that's how you run that. You would invest in that, because otherwise, how are you managing that inventory? You needed data-minded people anyway to begin with. So they're already there. They just change the way they work. And if they can get better tools from someone like, well, apparently Amazon, then they'll use them, because it optimizes their workflow and means that instead of all these manual reports, maybe they get to cut out 5 or 6 of them. Something as basic as like man hours spent on extracting and modifying CSV files, like Excel files. You'd be amazed how much of a difference that makes to the tools that people prefer to use. And this study was very much based on their preference.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, I'm not that surprised to hear that, to be honest with you, because that is absolutely at the core of everyone's business, right? Is how much time do staff spend on X, Y, Z, etc. So if you've got a tool that's streamlining that activity, then absolutely you're going to be winning out. It'll be really interesting to see how this plays out, right? Because this is quite a difference in popularity in a 12-month period. This is a report that's been run, I'm not sure for how many years, but it was certainly run last year as well and reported completely different results. Mm-hmm. So Amazon are really gaining some traction here. What do you think, Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised to see Amazon kind of rising up the ranks as much as they have done. I think there's still a way to go before they get anywhere near Google, because Google, for many publishers, Google is the only exchange or the only SSP sort of in existence for them. And Google is the obvious choice because it's just so accessible. And if you are a smaller publisher, Google is the kind of company that can work more closely with you and give you the support you need, which you need to have.
And you don't need engineers to set it up.
Exactly.
Crucially.
You can do it yourself. Yeah. And they have, you know, they have a huge team of support. Of support staff that can kind of help you kind of with regular emails or calls if you need it, like half an hour a month, which is frankly useless. But if you don't know anything, you might find that very, very useful. I don't know. But they know how to work with the SMEs. They know how to work with the smaller publishers. That's always been the case. And I think Amazon can get there too, because Amazon have that experience from as a platform for the marketplace perspective, and now from the demand side too. Amazon will be a strong contender with Google in how they kind of target and speak with those smaller publishers that need that support and need that handholding. I think Amazon could make themselves that contender with Google on that front.
Relevant to those publishers.
And everybody else on my list is the people that you need a team internally to be able to run and manage. And that makes sense. And they're all kind of very much middle of the pack, and they will be. I feel like kind of how they are this year versus where they were last year very much reflects how they've done. Like when we've talked about them as businesses, how they've done. So Rubicon Project has gone up in the list from like 7 to 5. And Rubicon as a business has seen, you know, has
got,
come
quite
from
a
really dark place and is now doing much, much better.
Yeah.
OpenX remains firmly middle of the pack. Mopub is increasing, which just shows, because Mopub is app only. It's showing that we talk a lot about kind of the growth of mobile and the growth of in-app. Actually, the fact that Mopub is still strongly within that list, kind of near the top, is there's a dearth of kind of in-app inventory and it's kind of being used. And then you've got kind of Index sort of at number 8. They work with sometimes more, they would argue, more discerning publishers that kind of really have a certain way about things and they want to kind of operate within this way, and they would use the Indexes of the world. So that kind of, it does definitely reflect I guess, who they are as businesses.
Those businesses. Yeah. Mm, yeah, that's what's really interesting, I guess.
But I'd also call out, like, the way they've done, like, research is often flawed as well. Mm. So they've interviewed, what, like 150 publishers, I think, and they filtered them to be publishers that had more than 3 million uniques. Mm. Again, this is U.S. studies.
Yeah.
And it's very much focused on net promoter score, which is...
which is perception.
Perception. Yeah. And the way that it's scored is they only look at the people who would actively promote or actively tell you don't go anywhere near
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And everybody in the middle is ignored. And there's a range all the way up to 6, I think, is considered like a detractor.
Mm.
Whereas so it's like on a scale of 0 to 10, anybody from 0 to 6 is considered somebody who would say, like, don't go anywhere
advocate.
Near it.
Yeah.
And then it's 7 and 8, I think, are passive. And yeah. 9 yeah. and 10 would actively promote. But there's quite a difference. Like, if I'm answering a survey, would you recommend, you, like, as an individual, culturally, this would change as well, depending on what country you're in.
Yes.
I might score like 5 is like, I don't know either way. Like, I don't mind either
that
way.
Which I would think would be a passive score,
yeah. but it's not. That would be considered on the NPS methodology as a detractor score.
Yeah. Totally. And if you're in Germany, they would give you a 4 and they think that was really good.
Right.
4
They'd
out of
be
10,
like, well done, you. Yeah, you got 4.
You've done really well.
You earned that 4.
Yeah, well done. And they'd be told, no, I actually hate this company. I don't want to use them anymore.
Right. But like, what I'm saying
right
is that
there,
like, there's a...
Yeah, choking, just yeah. quietly choking to death in the background. It's all good. Carry on.
But there's like a... there's sort of a landscape view here that's not going to come through, because this is all aggregated results across 155 publishers that probably have very different shaped businesses, different priorities. And the reality continues to be that whatever SSP you want to use, you have to apply the correct due diligence for your business.
Yeah.
If it makes sense to just work with Google because you don't have the people... and you need access to the forums and the, you know, the ability to ask anybody else in the world how to fix something because you didn't get an answer that you wanted from Google support, mm-hmm. then you should probably use Google and probably don't spread yourself so thin to use anybody else. But if your business demands that you have 8 and you're constantly, you know, setting up 6 screens at your desk to monitor this massive trading operation that you've got running, then that's what you should do. And you should absolutely take pride in your work and do it correctly. So I think... There just isn't a one size fits all. So that's the case with any research, that you just have to apply the common sense filter when you're going to go and put it in your own business.
But yeah, I guess it's a good point though, isn't it? Because you've got research like this, you've got things like the Forrester Wave reports as well that kind of will plot these companies in certain areas, and either they're pay to play or they are based on potentially flawed logic or flawed research practices, or kind of questionable or that don't make sense logically.
Just like, possibly not suitable.
But these companies will ride on the back of this for probably quite a while, saying, you know, I'm number 1, I'm number 4, I've gone up from number 6. But actually, if you are a publisher, there's a lot more you should be looking at, not like, oh my God, these guys moved up 3 spaces, I must now start working with them.
Well, this is,
yeah, every DMP conversation I think I've ever had for the past 5 years, they've shown me the Forrester Wave report.
Oh, I bet they have.
Nice.
Yeah.
That doesn't answer any of my questions.
What does that actually mean then?
Did you read the note? So, like, you're absolutely right. Like, it's a very valuable piece of work for the people on it, I think.
Yes.
So this is the thing.
Potentially. I mean, it depends on the quality of your questions. If you're going to go buy anything, you should be asking the correct questions and make sure you buy the right thing, not just because somebody told you that they were in the top 3.
Absolutely. Mm. So I'd have thought something like this, I'd have thought if you were a publisher, if I was a publisher, I'd use it simply to go, well, these results are interesting. A bit like the way that you've interpreted it, you know, to arrive at your point of view today, Nicola, I'd look at it and think, well, this is interesting. Why are these SSPs being ranked by this? Who have they asked? What size business are they? Where are they operating? Why would those people have answered in this way? But then if you were from a sort of a what's happening in the market point of view, I find the macro point, the macro sort of learnings a little bit more interesting mm-hmm. here, because at a macro level, it tells us just that Amazon's aggressively, you know, pushing into that advertising market, and they're doing really well actually at getting share of voice.
Well, getting in front of these people. Absolutely. And getting used and giving them a product that they seem to want to use and prefer to use.
Absolutely.
So they appear to be earning it based on this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's about all that tells us. It'd be really interesting to see something like this, a task like this attempted in Europe, across European regions, just
absolutely.
To see what the results would be. And you would pretty confidently expect that people would only be working with a much smaller group of SSPs.
Yeah, unless they're looking at reports like this and thinking, well, the US is doing it, so I must copy, because
so
they must know what they're doing.
Get 8 on the roster
right.
as well.
Right.
Interesting.
Which is it, one or the
Throw
other
into
happens.
This podcast, they either, so they yeah. can know that that's absolute rubbish.
Yes,
and
it's not necessarily rubbish. It might be the right thing to do, but like you're the only one who's going to know that from the inside.
Well, you need to do your work, right? Yeah. So you need to be interrogating pretty much everything that you're handed in terms of this is what you should be doing. You need to be really matching that against your own objectives.
Absolutely, I don't believe anything till I see a report. And they say, oh, we're the best. And I guess that's nice. I'd like to see the report.
Excellent.
I'd like to see your answers to my following 10 questions, and then we'll consider discussing further. I'm not very nice. It's not much fun trying to sell to me, to be honest. I make it tough. Well, we work with people
so
who earn the right.
Do.
Yeah, exactly. That means that you're doing your job properly,
I hope
right?
so. I hope I'm not just being like annoying in the corner.
I imagine certain salespeople will definitely think that.
But salespeople can be annoying too, you see. So there you are. You're just
well, everybody
giving it
gets
back to
a certain amount of annoying that they get to spend how they see fit throughout the day.
Yes. Very good point, actually. I've noticed our
CEO. How's that work in this office?
I was just about to say, I've noticed our CEO, Kieran, likes to pretty much dedicate most of his annoying behaviour towards the Mad Tech podcast when I have him sitting here talking over the top of people, pretending that he's the moderator instead of me, trying to control things.
That's chosen.
We love you,
Kieran. How he chooses to spend his Wednesday annoying budget.
That's exactly it. He also chooses to spend his daily annoying budget on other days in other ways, doesn't he, Minty?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
We love it. We'd have nothing to talk about if it wasn't for Kieran Entertainment. Great. So we're running thin on time. So let's move on to having a bit of a chat about what you're working on at Condé Nast at the moment, Nicole. It sounds like you've got some really interesting stuff going on in Condé Nast International. Tell me a little bit about that. You mentioned in the prep for this that it's a sort of a new-ish division or establishment within the Condé Nast family. So tell us about that.
So absolutely. So I work in the international team. We look after everything other than the US, or historically we sort of manage the business end across 11 owned and operated markets plus like a couple dozen additional. So there's 32 markets where Condé Nast has operations globally. So the US is just one of the 32, and Condé Nast International would be all the 31s. That said, we've recently opened new markets, so we're continuing to open new markets. For example, we recently launched titles in Hong Kong, Greece, the Middle East. And what that's showing us is that there continues to be places to go and a demand for localized content and local expertise. So one of our biggest strong points in our sort of mega brand, super brand world is that if you go to pretty much any region where we operate and park yourself across the street from a newsstand, you'll generally find people purchasing more than one Vogue. They want to see the French Vogue, but they also want to see the Italian Vogue, and they want to see how the shows were covered differently or how the commentary was handled differently. And the imagery is completely different. All of the expertise is super localized, and that's one of our strongest points is our localized voice. But in my team, we have to think about the global view, so we're sort of boring corporate headquarters style, where we have to look at back office infrastructure about what tools we're using to get that content out there, what tools we're using to get the ads in place and make sure that they deliver as promised and in as many places as physically possible, depending on wherever the advertiser wants to be across this network, essentially, of 32 businesses. And that function has expanded very quickly. I've been there about 3 years. And like I was saying, on my first day when I joined, all 10 of us went for ice cream because we had five new starters that day and we were doubling in size. And now I think I should have double checked the number, but I think we're like 250 or 300 people just in the London headquarters. And that sort of energy is distributed into every business division you could imagine, from finance to editorial. We have a central hub, a Vogue editorial international hub here in London, producing content that gets distributed to the markets to use and publish and adapt and do what they need to with it to make it sing locally. We also centralize production of fashion shows now. So, you know, the same image was being cropped and edited and tagged by 32 different people. That doesn't need to happen anymore. That happens centrally. So the commentary and the analysis can be done in 32 places where it should be done, but they don't need to all be sitting there cropping pictures.
Yeah.
Things like that. are essentially the mainstay of the types of projects that we're running out of my team. Or not my team, sorry, out of the team that I'm in. I'm not doing anything to do with fashion show production. I just know about it.
Why not? Very stylish person,
yeah,
Nicole.
Check me out. No, I don't have time for that because I'm
too busy
running a million other things.
Yeah. And shouting at salespeople for not
right.
saying they're number one in a recent research report.
Yes, exactly. So I work very closely in my team. I'm actually within the data and insight team, which is an unusual composition as well, because we are essentially the commercial... We're a subject matter experts of ad tech and commercial platforms, and we sit within the data and insight team alongside our counterparts across web analytics and user behavior, audience research, CRM, audience CRM, so for all of our like subscriptions and newsletters and communities. And having us side by side and reporting in the same function, we essentially tell the complete story to any question the business wants to ask. Such as, you know, what should my article design look like on this new platform that we're developing? Where should the ads go? What do we want the users to do? What do we want them to see first? How do we want them to interact? And in order to answer that question with a holistic view of quantitative, qualitative, factual, historical information, they can get that from our team, mm-hmm. essentially. In order to have that information organized and in an excellent capacity, we also need to own the stack and the partnerships with the technology vendors that we use and the configurations of how those things are labeled and implemented and set up and what we can and cannot offer on our platforms. So there's an enormous amount of collaboration and networking with our local teams, because every single team has a sale, every single market has a sales team and an ops team and a print production team and an editorial team. And so in order to essentially get everybody on to the same platforms and tools, they have to work for China, Russia, and everybody else, or they're not going to work.
So that must be quite a tough ask when you're coming to sort of, you know, establish a set yeah. of tools. Yeah, right. Mm.
It is. Well, and in some cases, for, you know, with the notable standout of China, there are some tools that just don't work for everybody in China. So we've made our peace with that. That's fine.
Yep.
But wherever possible, the intention is for everybody to be at least using the same tools. So nobody's spending any time thinking about tools. Instead, they're thinking about how am I using this tool to generate the best possible business outcome for my region or for my title.
Yeah.
And sort of taking all of that distraction away and pulling it up to the center. And that has so far been extremely successful. It's just moving at an incredible pace. And what it's also allowing us to do is essentially make progress in aligning what we offer to the outside world as well. So our advertisers can increasingly, as we make our way through this giant program, start coming to one team and buying multiple regions or buying multiple titles, where before that just would have been logistically really challenging to achieve.
And they'd have had to have gone to every region mm-hmm. individually to
yeah.
buy.
Yeah, okay. they would have had to do the legwork, essentially. Yeah. We do have a central commercial team now that does a lot of that work for them, but they still then have to go speak to all these people and say, well, what does your website look like? What size are your banners and where do they go and all of that? So one of the biggest projects that's come out of this function, one of the first things that the chief digital officer, now president, wanted to prioritize when he first took the role, three years ago, was to get everybody onto a central CMS, so they're publishing their content the same way to the same place, and a centralized web platform, so the websites operate and look the same and can be optimized in one place and iterated very, very quickly rather than trying to iterate across 32 places. Mm. So we have, in the first 6 months of this year, we've launched our Vogue and GQ brands onto the new titles, onto the new platform across Italy, Mexico, UK, Germany, India. And I'm forgetting somebody. But anyway, we're launching them at a pace in order to get everybody onto this platform, because it has been designed from scratch with user experience in mind, focusing on page speed, Coalition for Better Ads compliance, high quality experiences for advertisers, but also for the user on the page, and basically ripping out all the complexity that is going to happen anyway as time goes by, and I don't know, organizing it so that everybody can focus again on moving forward in the same direction.
That must have been one hell of a job, though.
It has been, and it's ongoing. We're not done yet. So yeah. We've only done a corner. So we're prioritizing our 11 owned and operated markets. And like I said, there's 32 total. So and we're only looking at Vogue and GQ, and we have 40 brands. So this is going to be a long project, but the momentum is picking up this year in particular. So we've really been on a launch schedule. I think we have a launch today, actually.
Wow. And you're still here recording the MedTech podcast with
us.
Well,
you know, we've it's such a well-oiled machine now. I don't need to be there.
Oh, that's it.
No, I'm kidding. It's in very good hands. So that's happening. That's a really huge project, but that's also a very internal. I mean, it's outward facing because you can go look at the new website. So you can go look at Vogue France's website now, and that's been running since Q4 last year, and you can see the results. That it's a faster experience. It's much less cluttered. The ads are optimized essentially. The product is optimized. Sorry. So that's sort of visible, but so much of the lifting has been behind the scenes and inside the business. So it's not all that exciting to talk about. Like, oh, congratulations, we're getting organized. But it's a huge undertaking and a big achievement for the team here.
And from an advertising perspective, you know, you must be seeing some improvements in that.
Significant
regard.
Improvements, especially in the area of viewability.
Yeah.
Where there's so many competing factors that affect viewability, and the ones that we have control over are how fast the page loads, where they load, and when they load.
Yeah.
Everything else is down to the weight of the creative, which is an ongoing battle that I just cannot believe is still a problem, but it is. So we are measuring the platform with a target of, you know, 70% viewability average. And there will be pockets that are higher or lower, and we're continuing to optimize. But of course, the product team will continue to be frustrated when they look at the scores and they're like, well, what about this day when it went down to 60? And I'll be like, well, that's because somebody ran a heavy ad. Mm. There's really nothing we can do about that. Mm. Well, that's not true. We can push it back. We could say no.
Yeah.
But of course, that's easier said than done. So there's managing all those competing business factors as well, and the stakeholders internally to understand these complex things that I find very interesting and fascinating, like how we manage all of these puzzle pieces and these plates that are spinning at the same time to achieve a business result that's strong and stable and can scale. But, you know, it is a complex specialist area, so it's probably best that it's just isolated in my little nerdery in the corner.
Well, you know, there's plenty of MedTech podcast listeners that would feel very interested by what you're saying, Nicole. You're not we've got our own little nerd sort of tower here at Exchange, don't we?
Yeah. But do you have the I guess the support kind of from a C level? Do they have the understanding of the advertising side of the business and how it works?
Absolutely.
They do.
Absolutely. It's an advertising business.
Right?
It's more like the complexities of, you know, someone says, oh, I'm so excited that we've got AMP everywhere. And I go, that's nice. You know that certain ad formats don't run on AMP, right? And that third-party cookies have difficulty spotting the first page, and that impacts certain segmentation strategies that we might want to roll out in the future. And they're like, oh. But the page is so fast. I go, yeah, on that note, the user's not hanging out and waiting for the content. So guess what? It's even more difficult to get the ad to render in time to hit the viewability marker. And they go,
do they then go, I'm just going to go and get myself a coffee. I'll catch you later, Nicole.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do AMP. I'm just,
no.
It's that level of detail where it's like anything that, you know, anybody in any business wants to say, look how great. And I go, yeah, but don't forget, we still have 700 other things we got to keep working on, keep going. So that's also a good reason why you would centralize it, or why we would pull a team together of specialists who can think about that all day, because trying to do that alongside actually running campaigns and fielding briefs and responding to things that arrive at 10 a.m. and must be done by 11, it's just not going to happen.
No.
So I feel very privileged to be in the position that I'm in, that I get to focus entirely on that.
And trying to get that right. Mm. You mentioned earlier as well, when we were having a little bit of a pre-chat, that it's also a part of the business where you're developing new products as well. So that sounds quite interesting. Tell us about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. So in the same way that my team gets to nerd out about ad tech, the business development team at CNI is completely detached from associations to individual markets. They just have an incubator framework where they assess new business cases for new revenue streams or diversification or improvements, and they have a completely cross-functional team to just go make it happen. And one of the outputs of that team that we're most proud of is the launch of Vogue Business. And so last year, this was beta tested as a newsletter specifically for B2B fashion news, essentially like And it was, I think, tested with 7,000 people from fashion houses to publishers to retailers to pretty much any industry you could imagine that would be interested in fashion news. There was a newsletter that was the original incarnation of it. And then based on immediate feedback iteration, they launched the website in January. And the website, of course, launched on the new platform. So it looks beautiful. And now, again, based on iteration and feedback, the newsletter now goes out 3 times a week instead of once a week. The website, you know, they're constantly making changes to how the content is packaged, bundled, presented. And just in June, they launched a section of Vogue Business that's specific to recruitment and talent for fashion brands and fashion jobs, which most large companies, in particular, luxury advertisers or even Condé Nast, we receive a lot of applications for every single role. Because people just want to get their CV into these brands that they recognize, and these companies desirable. That they really want to work for, but they're not always exercising essentially their due diligence to apply for the role that they'll be relevant for, which means the people fielding all of those CVs have quite a lot to sift through to find the strong candidates who really do believe in the role and really do want to be a picture editor for Vogue, or for example. And so what we've developed is a platform essentially for curated recruitment for the fashion industry, and we're very excited about that. That launched in June.
Yeah.
And it's on the Vogue Business website /talent, I believe.
Yeah. That's really interesting. These are new potential revenue streams
for
you guys. You're obviously mixing up your monetization model, looking at what works. And
well, everybody has to do that. Yeah, like we're not the first to be trying new things. No. That's obviously not special. But what we think is unique is the sort of the angle that we can bring on it with the expertise that we have across our business. So all of our editors in chief or all of our essentially team members in all of these regions have a lot of very specialist knowledge to bring to bear, both for the content but for how we shape these products. And all of it is based on iterating based on the feedback from these sort of beta testers.
Yeah. Sounds great.
So it's, product development in action. We're very excited to see it happen.
That's cool. And I still think there's an opportunity for team ice cream.
Yeah, it's just smaller teams. Like my team's 10 now.
Oh, well, so there you go. So you can definitely do team ice cream. I like it. We're going to start implementing that here at Exchange. We already have team Kit Kats, which is pretty much every day.
Yeah.
We might need to slow down on the Kit Kat.
Mint Magnums.
Team Mint Magnums. We need to try that.
The Japanese team actually brought wasabi flavored Kit Kats.
Yeah.
Oh, we've had them in the office.
We have.
I'm not going to touch it, but there's one guy on the team who really likes them, and he wasn't in. And I was like, so they brought some wasabi Kit Kats for you. Well, for us, but they're pretty safe on my desk when you when you get back in, you can just go ahead and pick them up.
Did he get
I think
them?
It's a specialist flavor.
Yes, it's definitely
Is that. I quite liked them. The Japanese got all sorts of crazy Kit Kat flavors.
They do,
it's
their
thing. It's quite fun.
Japan's
sifting your way through them.
Different place, isn't
it? I know.
It?
Yeah. Fabulous.
Yeah.
Fabulous place. I think we've run out of time.
We certainly have, haven't we? Okay.
Thank you very much, Nicole. That was
Thank
really
you for having me.
Interesting conversation. It was great to have you here in the office on the Mad Tech Podcast. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.